to everyone out this morning. Hope that you had a good week. If you're following along this morning, we're going to be in Mark, the third chapter. And we're going to look at the 13th through 19th chapters. Starting in verse 13, "And he went up to the mountain and summoned those whom he himself wanted. And they came to him, and he appointed 12, that they might be with him, and that he might send them out to preach, and to have authority to cast out demons. And he appointed the 12, Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, and James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James. To them he gave the name Boanerges, which means son of thunder, and Andrew, and Philip, and Bartholomew, and Matthew, and Thomas, and James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, and Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who also betrayed him." I don't know if you remember a movie a while back. It's called Places in the Heart. It had Sally Field, John Malkovich, and Danny Glover, and Ed Harris. And the movie's set during the Depression era. It's a small town, and the sheriff is killed, leaving a wife and two small children to try and eke out a living on their small cotton farm that they had. Now, when the bank threatens to foreclose, the widow takes in a boarder, a blind veteran of World War I, played by John Malkovich. Later, a black drifter, played by Danny Glover, takes up residence there also. Together, the widow, the blind man, and the black man, and two children, try to pull off the impossible, to get the first load of cotton picked and hauled to the gin so that they can win a monetary prize sufficient to save their farm. You know, the most compelling thing about this movie and other ones like it is the odd mix of characters who make up the central cast of characters. A widow with no farming skills or knowledge, a blind man who is bitter about his life, and a black man who struggles with honesty, and two little children. You ever notice how often this formula is used in many stories? The odd couple, you have a neat freak and then a slob, and they learn to live together. And of course, remember the comedy show Gilligan's Island with its odd mix of characters, different there, but somehow they got by. And the war movie, The Dirty Dozen, where 12 hardened military criminals are put together with a colonel who's in trouble with his commanders, and they try to lead a suicide mission. And it isn't just television shows and movies. Disparate characters all unite in a common quest populate some of our greatest works of literature. To Kill a Mockingbird, The Grapes of Wrath, Of Mice and Men. All of these had characters and the richness of mixing different people together who will clash and fight, and they'll come together but eventually move forward for a common goal. Now, as a young Scottish boy, his name was Angus, who decided to try life in Australia, he found an apartment in a small block and settled in. After 2 weeks, his mother called from Aberdeen to see how her son was doing in his new life. He said, "I'm fine," Angus said, "but there are some really strange people living in these apartments here. One woman cried all day long. Another lies on her floor, moaning. And there's a guy next door to me who bangs his head on the wall all the time." "Well, my laddie," said his mother, "I suggest you don't associate with people like that." "Oh," said Angus, I don't. "No, I just stay inside my apartment and play my bagpipe day and night." You know, there's another famous book that brings tons of stories in which odd mixtures of characters are drawn together to form a close-knit community. Well, that's the Bible. Let me show you what I mean. Do you remember the scriptures that we just read from Mark 3? It is the selection of 12 men from the hundreds of followers that Jesus had that he would take and train to save the world. Now let's take a look at a few of these. Matthew and Simon the Zealot. Matthew was a tax collector. Simon would have been a tax protester. Matthew was a revenuer for the Romans. Simon was a rebel. He liked challenging things. He was always ready for a fight or scrap. Matthew was wealthy. Simon was a commoner, being a fisherman. Matthew made his money overcharging people like Simon, and Simon lived to eliminate people like Matthew from his life. Now, there's an odd couple for you. With that in mind, let's take a look at another passage in Acts 2. In Acts 2, verses 5 through 12, now there were Jews living in Jerusalem, devout men from every nation under heaven. And when this sound occurred, the multitude came together and were bewildered because they were each one hearing them speak in their own language. And they were amazed and marveled, saying, "Why are not all these who are speaking Galileans? And how is it that we hear, each hear them in their own language, to which we were born? Parthians and Medes and Elamites and residents of Mesopotamia, Judea, Cappadocia, Pontus and Asia, Phrygia, Pamphylia, Egypt, and the districts of Libya around, Cyrene and visitors from Rome, both Jews and proselytes, Cretans and Arabs, we hear them in their own tongue speaking of the mighty deeds of God." And they all continued in amazement and great perplexity, saying to one another, "What does this mean?" Now remember the Tower of Babel? This was the undoing of Babel. You know, the first miracle in the church was not tongue-speaking. It was community-making. And the reason it qualifies as a miracle is because it runs counter to the norm. It was a supernatural thing that all the disciples, or all these people, could hear them in their own language. Now, we think of the UN, and we see these people with these little recording or microphones or speakers on their ear. And that's there so that when someone speaks whatever language they're speaking, there's an interpreter that can translate that on the fly and speak it as the other person speaks it, and that person can understand it. Well, think of that on a supernatural level. We hear all these people, Romans, Medes, and Persians, and all these different people who spoke different languages. Now, maybe they had a little bit of a command of common language because they were all there to do commerce. But when the apostles spoke, each one heard them, just like that UN guy was. They heard in their own language. Now, the Tower of Babel, the languages would change so that man would not become too quickly wise like God was. But now, when it came down to salvation, it was heard by all. There's an article about a study done by Harvard University and the Civil Rights Project. Now that many schools are no longer under court-mandated desegregation, sociologists are tracking the pattern called resegregation. Ethnic groups, different families, usually live in separate neighborhoods, so schools are beginning to reflect the demographics of the communities around them. Schools are becoming almost exclusively one race or another, and it's a natural human response to differences. But when you look at how the story of the gospel begins and how the church was born, it becomes clear that God is more in favor of us being a diverse group together than anything else. Romans 5:7 puts it this way: "Accept one another just as Christ accepted you in order to bring praise to God." No matter what a person's background is, or no matter what their quirks and idiosyncrasies might be, that's a child of God. No matter if you're a big sports fan and someone else is not a sports fan, you can all come and unite on the Word of God. You can come and stand together and praise God on those terms. So what do we do with the passage and others that celebrate that bringing together of all kind of odd groupings? Now let me suggest a few responses. First, we need to recognize that the church is going to be a magnet for some who may not fit in with society. They may have faced a lot of trials and tribulations. Many of us came to God when life was not dealing very fairly with us, or as people think life should deal fairly with them in life. And we came to know God and we cherish that time. And we don't look upon that time as a bad time because it brought us to God. It made the opportunity possible that maybe you and I could have come to God. Now, some kind of naturally were in the church as children. Their parents were church members, and they just kind of got brought up into it. And, you know, that happens too. We need to recognize that we are a diverse group. And Matthew was a person who was on the out with most of the people in society. No one liked to see the tax collector. I remember one scene in a Christmas Story, a popular movie. And I guess way back when, they sent the tax man out, and I guess they were in Michigan. They sent out a tax man to go in and inventory what you had bought that year. I guess maybe that was before sales taxes and things like that. And they would assess the tax over what that man put there. So it went through the neighborhoods that the tax man was coming. So in every house, there was housewives throwing stuff in the attic, hiding stuff, and putting stuff here and there, so that when he went through, you know, their taxes would be as low as possible. So no one likes the tax man. No one wants to pay taxes. For that matter, so was Jesus out with most of his society. You know, people look at Jesus as a rebel, and they had a kind of have a hippie calling, and because they see all those medieval paintings of him with long blonde hair and sandals, and he kind of got caught up in the hippie culture in the 60s and the Jesus freaks and all that. Jesus was not a rebel. You can't be a rebel if you call the shots. In fact, what he did, he came back to put them, first of all, on the right path for the Jewish people of that day, and then established his church after that. Jesus is part of the Godhead. He's not a rebel. He calls the shots. But he didn't fit in with that society there, and neither did his disciples. And what he told his disciples, if they're going to persecute me, if they're going to put me on a cross and kill me, and you are my servant, do you think they're going to treat you any better? Christians should not go out into the world and look to get treated well by people. In fact, it's getting worse now. There are places where they try to stop people from having house meetings in neighborhoods, try to have it labeled a church or anything like that, where you can't just get together with your church friends and study the Bible in small house groups and stuff. So people just hate Christianity, and they're going to hate us. And they're going to hate us because we're here in church. We follow God. We do it. We talked about this morning about how the Bible tells us that we're going to judge the wicked. And I talked about how we're not going to actually sit on a throne and you know, call out names and deeds and have people condemned. But they are going to be judged by us. Because if they say, well, you didn't come down and present yourself to me, God. You didn't show yourself to me. Well, how can I believe in you? And God says, they did. And they say, well, it was too hard to give myself to you and give up all my life. I enjoyed my life too much. You can't hold me to that. You can't punish me for something like that. And God will say, they did. And on. That's how the world is judged, by us. So, we may not fit in. We may meet people that don't fit in. We've all met characters. I'm sure we could tell stories about them. But they were Christian brothers and sisters, and they needed our love just as much as anyone did. And God had a purpose for them. You may have looked at him and said, you know, what on earth purpose could there possibly be for this person? But God has a purpose for them. So when the church is a magnet for those who are different, I don't mean to be disrespectful in any way. We're all different from the world. We're all here. In fact, the world probably looks at us and, you know, thinks we're a half a bubble off. We're not playing with a full deck. The elevator doesn't go to the top. You know, the light's on, but nobody's human. Other terms people come up with to say people are less intelligent than they should be. But we're all different from the world, and we need to recognize that. You know, I heard of a family who was a little bit into these holistic medicines and things like that, and on a retreat, the son was suffering from a headache, and knowing his the family's thoughts, the minister who was there with them asked what he could do for them. You know, he didn't want to just give them some medicine or anything like that. He wanted to respect the parents' wishes. Well, the young man asked for a cabbage leaf in a dark place where he could sit and meditate for a few hours. So they gave him a room, and he sat there for 2 hours with the cabbage leaf on his head. Now, we may look at that and say, I just don't see it. It doesn't make sense to me or anything like that. But they were dear Christian people, raising their kids in the church, sending them out on the retreats for the kids so that they could learn more. And we need to respect people who are like that. They come to the kingdom too, and they have things to offer. I'm sure they talk to all their holistic friends when they got together for whatever meetings they might have about all these herbs and things like that, and could have brought some of them there. In Huntsville, I heard of a fellow named Clarence, a single man who basically lived in his own little world. He would greet everyone with a hello, brother, I love you oh so much, and then give you a big hug and a kiss on the neck. Now, he had three cars. He had a 1976 Volkswagen Beetle that was green. He had another car. It was a 1976 Volkswagen Beetle that was green. And his third car was a 1976 green Volkswagen Beetle. So, we may think that that's a bit odd or a bit strange, but here was a person exercising the love we should all have for each other. And what a great thing that is. Every church can have those who are different. But if you think about it, isn't that what God wants from us? He wants us all to be diverse. He wants us to come from all walks of life. He wants us to have all kind of talents so that when that right person is experiencing their own moment out there, when they don't fit in or don't feel that life is taking care of them, or when they feel that there's something more to life than that, you may be just the person to broach the subject. Well, let me tell you how I live. Or let me tell you what gets me through. Let me tell you what I trust in. And you may help that person find God. In fact, I think it's quite possible that you can judge a church's faithfulness by how many folks are there from different places and different backgrounds that they are there. And we have many small churches around, and they're basically almost like a few families. And all the kids are in there. There's maybe one, two, maybe three different families. Sometimes they're even related and intermarried. And they're just all those people in that singular church. And there's no one from another background there or another, you know, diversity there. So they just keep bringing in the same old family members and everything as they expand and grow and lose a few. But to truly be from a diverse background gives us so many opportunities out there. You know, the New Testament shows the early church grappling with issues of inclusion in places like Acts 10 and Acts 15. In passages like 1 Corinthians 11 and James 2, the apostles confronted those different personalities there. You had Jew and Gentile. In Philemon, Paul urged a slave owner to welcome whom his recently converted runaway slave as a brother. Clearly, the first Christians didn't always do a very good job of bridging the canyon that separated people. Otherwise, the writers wouldn't have to address the issues so much. But the issues were addressed. The divine standard was revealed, and the churches were expected to live up to it. After the church was brought first to the Jews, then it went out to the Gentiles. It went out into all the world with people of different cultures, different personalities. And even within cultures and different personalities, you have different people. They recognize the mandate of Matthew 28 that Christians are to go out into all the world and preach the gospel and then to pursue the mission with zeal. But sometimes they insist on taking their culture with them and trying to spread that. You know, there are immigrant churches, if you want to call them that, churches who know where home really is. Immigrant churches and Christians recognize there's a difference between their own religious culture and the gospel of Jesus. They realize that there are certain things they're comfortable with, certain ways of expressing their faith that they like and are familiar and even long cherished. But they are willing to relax or even let go of those things if it means accepting someone who is different. They know how to deal with that. And we need to be a church of immigrants, so to speak, that we can learn to cast off all the traditions that are just traditions. Now, many of our traditions are caught up in our doctrines, and of course they're essential. But we need to be able to hear those of a different voice, of a different culture, who can bring a richness and a diversity to our group here. We need to be able to do that. We need to be able to embrace and love those who don't fit in maybe sometimes with what we might call our normal behavior or, you know, commonplace acting. Norman Schwarzkopf tells an interesting story in his autobiography. His father had been an ambassador to Saudi Arabia. He once traveled with his father to visit some Bedouins. They were welcomed to a large tent where their host had spread a traditional Bedouin feast. The centerpiece of the feast was a camel, fully cooked, but still mostly intact. I guess kind of like an intact pig that some people cook up most of the time. The chief of the Bedouin tribe immediately took a liking to young Norman and offered him the choicest morsel on the table, the camel's eyeball. I know that some in those cultures even eat goat's eyeballs, but, you know, that'd be kind of strange and squeamish to us. Schwarzkopf writes that his father didn't even have to take a look at him. He knew what to do. He popped the eyeball in his mouth and swallowed it and kept it down. Any other response would have been an unforgivable insult. He squelched his gag response. Now, we might be squeamish, and I know the thought of doing something like that is kind of appalling, but here was someone that he was trying to reach, or that the government and his father, being the ambassador, were trying to reach and form bonds and friendship. Sometimes we have to do those things to help meet the needs of others. Helping people feel welcome and accepted is more important than suiting our own taste sometimes. We need to make people feel like they're important, and they are. They're important to God, they're important to us, they're important, you know, to the lives that we live. We never know when that person may walk through the door. When they may be someone we think, well, I don't think I'll click with this person. And we may wonder and say, oh, I hope they don't come sit next to me. And they do. But then when you get to know them, they can become your best friend. Never let appearances, never let the way people act, never let any of that get in the way of our Christian love for each other. Never let that stop you from spreading the gospel to someone else or inviting them somewhere or anything like that, because that's what it's all about. Making people feel welcome and loved in these surroundings. We know that Jesus gave up a lot to be with us. He gave up being in heaven to walk some dirty streets. He left heaven and all the glory there to come down here and be with us. He gave up a lot for us. And we need to be, first of all, willing to accept people. Second of all, be willing to integrate them into our group. Third, we need to see their talents and let them explore those talents and let them grow where they might. And then fourthly, we need to recognize that we will grow with diversity, that we will grow with those around us. And I think that's important to note, that as we look at the apostles and their diversity, and we look at ourselves and our diversity, we all have a common goal. We all have a common purpose that binds and unites us and brings us here in love for ourselves and God. But in the end, we have to look around us, and we have to be accepting of those that would come into our fold and share with us in that love. I don't know what your needs may be this morning or what your condition is, but if you have need of the church, won't you come as you stand and sing the song of invitation?